Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Mark Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course, so it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. If it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much in the way you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look at these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedom's Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedom's Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make if your remedy is in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call board and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if we dispose properly and then answer properly, then we can all learn something from it. All right, that is my ramble for this evening, folks. Tonight's speaker
is Mr. PJ is tonight's speaker, and he will be shortly joining us and explaining to us what he's about to hear with regards to land patents and allodial title, which he can springboard from and then also go into the other directions that he wants to go in. So let's start where we left off last week. Last week we talked about the allodial title, and now we're going to talk about the switch, federal liens and property taxes. In the de jure United States of America and under the common law, the land patent is the highest evidence of title for the sovereign American state citizen, evidence of allodial title and true ownership. But in a bankrupt and de facto federal United States inhabited by U.S. citizens and directed by its creditors under admiralty law, the land patent is collateral is hypothecated against the debt which has been fraudulently transferred to the international bankers. That having been said, it's important to understand that there is a hidden federal lien on all property and real estate in the federal United States because the federal debt is to the International Monetary Fund, the same place that ultimately ends up receiving your birth certificate. This federal lien is not attached to the land, but to the property and real estate situated a millisecond above the land. It is assessed and collected through property tax. We should note that a gentleman named Eric Madsen asserts that the real estate of the United States of America was quitclaim deeded to the International Monetary Fund by the last sitting United States Supreme Court in 1944 as their latest action. The rights and the title to the land itself still belongs to we the people. Discover how much federal debt is attached to your property and real estate simply by writing the Department of the Interior and requesting an accounting of what portion of the federal debt is attached to your property. To motivate them, tell them you want to pay off the debt in full. Borrow the Federal Reserve notes if necessary to discharge the debt in full, or offer to pay the debt in full with gold and silver, which, of course, they will refuse to accept. Now you can sue the title insurance company for treble damages for not revealing the hidden federal lien when you purchased the property and real estate in the first place. They failed to perform on their end of the contract, and they will likely settle out of court. This is where PJ and the team come in. This is why you're here tonight. These are the people that know the litigation route. This lien must be satisfied, paid, or released to own equitable title to your property and real estate free and clear, as well as any outstanding mortgages or bank mortgages. Then notify the county tax assessor that the taxes, that is the liens, have been satisfied in full, and to please take you off of the tax rolls forever. Lien and debt release process is as follows. There's a federal lien on all property and real estate. You need to discover how much debt is attached to your land. Borrow the Federal Reserve notes if necessary to discharge the debt in full, or like we said, pay in full in gold and silver. Sue the title company, notify the county tax assessor that the tax has been paid in full, and to send no more deeds. That's what's all done. The deed is a sales instrument. It's a trust. If a deed is recorded at the county recorder's office, then the property or the real estate is the trust property of the state. Let's repeat that. If a deed is recorded at the county recorder's office, then the property or the real estate is the trust property of the state. The land, property, and real estate must be then reconveyed out of the county recorder's office with a quick claim deed from equity into common law. We should note that no rights convey or are warranted with a quick claim deed. A warranty deed, on the other hand, does grant the land and admits valuable consideration, bargain, sells, and conveys the appurtenances and warrants the performance of the contract. And let's look at the elements of the warranty deed. First, ask the question, what is a deed? It has to admit to valuable consideration, which is a thought process. It must have full disclosure. It must have $21 of real money in evidence of consideration. 21 silver dollars would work just fine. It grants right and title to land, and it is not bought or sold. It's free. Those who do not update the patent have abandoned the right and must be brought up in your sovereign name, which is another reason to correct your status. The bargain is sold and conveyed. Equity is fairness. Chattel and other appurtenances. Stuff and improvements on the land is bought. Assignments is responsibility, and it must be accepted or admitted. Warrants performance. It will defend the title if contested. Exclusions such as easements, right of ways, access of water, water rights. These cannot convey and cannot be warranted. Economic sovereignty and lawful money regarding a federal land patent must be a sovereign state citizen free of all legal disabilities to hold title to any land in the United States of America. Furthermore, get yourself out of the indebtedness and become economically sovereign as quickly as possible. Then individually, you won't need to loan from the bank. As a sovereign state citizen, you will not qualify for any loan at any bank, but foreign entities through which the property or real estate is purchased can. Getting a loan is not paying for it either, because the bank hasn't loaned you any money. You can't borrow debt. You can purchase the property or real estate even with a purported loan, providing the loan is not in your name. Let a foreign entity or a trust purchase the property directly, and that would qualify for the loan. Rights and title to land does not convey without the tendering of real money or consideration. Consideration is a thought process, and the money is evidence of that. If you haven't tendered at least 21 silver dollars in the purchase of the real property or the real estate, then it hasn't been bought. Do not place the land in escrow. Do not get title insurance or use the land as collateral or security against any debt. These are adhesion contracts, and remove any true title from the land as a condition of the contract. There are no rights or title conveyed on the improvements or buildings on the land, only equitable title and interest. Remember, if the property and real estate is recorded at the county recorder, then it's a trust property of the state, and you can simply have only the equitable title. A trust or foreign entity can hold equitable title, though, while a sovereign individual makes a claim to the true title. The property and real estate must be reconveyed to a trust or foreign entity when purchased with a bill of sale. But do not re-record with the county recorder. In matters of deeds and conveyances, you must be educated and know what you're doing. Allodial title, equitable title, and protection from foreclosure. You protect the land from foreclosure, from the foreclosure action of banks, unlawful seizure and forfeiture by the government, and prevent foreclosure by the international bankers when the federal United States government is officially declared. Allodial existed in feudal land, in feudal law, and it was land held absolutely in one's own right and not of any superior lord. Land is not subject to feudal duties or its burdens. A mortgage is a commercial lien and does not convey an estate or title. A bank has to prove it has title to the land in order to take it over. A title company insures absolutely nothing except the land. Allodial titles only apply to the land, and it does not apply to the improvements upon the land, which can still be attached with a commercial lien, although your creditors cannot walk across the land to seize the improvements without a trespass to the land. Today, most American people do not own their land, not even after they've paid off their mortgage or they've satisfied the bank note. This comes as a surprise, perhaps a shock to most people. Instead of sovereign allodial ownership of property as the Founding Fathers intended, most people have only temporary possession and minimal control over a piece of land for so long as they pay the bank note, pay the taxes, submit to building codes and regulations, and the government doesn't condemn or take the land for public use with or without compensation. Americans have not yet figured out that they have so little control over what they do on, quote, their land, end quote, because they do not own it. The federal United States government maintains the true title in the original land patent, which it has pledged as collateral against the federal debt. If you had a true title, the government could not utilize your land as security against the federal debt. Your government, the international bankers by way of the Federal Reserve Bank, have been using your land for its own purposes without your knowledge or consent. Getting a mortgage and paying a bank note is nothing more than glorified renting, a qualified and diminished ownership, and a return to a feudal relationship with the land that serfs and slaves endured for hundreds of years. Qualified ownership means that the ownership of land is shared with the government, while absolute ownership is not shared. The underlying reason the American Revolution was fought and won was over the right for the sovereign, the state citizens, to own land absolutely, without government encroachment of any kind. The Founding Fathers abhorred the idea of feudal land and owning allegiance to any foreign or sovereign power. The American people have unwittingly surrendered their allodial titles and sovereign rights as a condition of every bank contract or mortgage involving the purchase of land or property, or the use of land and property as collateral and bought with debt currency, money substitutes, checks, or other negotiable instruments. You can only discharge debt with a negotiable instrument. I repeat, you can only discharge debt with a negotiable instrument. You can't pay it. The only way that you can pay a debt is with substantive money, gold, silver. Since you never actually pay for it with lawful money, unless it was gold or silver, you cannot own your land or property either. You are merely renting property with a rented debt currency system. Look at the deed that you have and notice the language. It refers to you as a tenant. All land not held in allodial title has been hypothecated to the Federal Reserve Bank as collateral against a federal debt that cannot be paid. As legal persons, not people, persons, U.S. citizens have no right to own land any more than a corporation or a trust could prior to the 14th Amendment. By defining U.S. citizens as legal persons, a doorway opened for legal persons such as corporations and trusts to gain control over land and to take it from the people. Citizens have entered adhesion contracts with the federal United States government under the 14th Amendment, whereby their unalienable rights to own land absolutely in an allodial state have been reduced to qualified ownership and color of title under the negotiable instruments in the 20th century. America has returned to the dark ages of feudalism. Its former state citizens have been reduced as tenants and renters, once again, not the sovereign owners of the land. Having an allodial title will not eliminate any debt or mortgage if any is presently attached to your land or property. The allodial title will prevent the creditor from going after your land to collect on the debt if you cannot make a payment, though, for any reason. After having received proper notice, your creditors have 60 days to challenge your declaration of land patent. If they don't, the land reverts to its allodial title. And if they do, they must take you to court, and you must demonstrate the superiority of your allodial title. The law is on the side of the sovereign state citizen regarding allodial titles. If for some reason you cannot pay your mortgage or default on your loan, instead of a bank foreclosure whereby you lose everything, a land trust might be created whereby you and the bank become partners in the property until it's paid. This is very similar to the Islamic method of loaning. Odd. With an allodial title, debts or claims will remain, but the land itself will forever be removed from assets upon which the creditors can attach. Allodial land cannot be foreclosed upon or liened. Debts or claims can be made through on the improvements, although no person is actually able to access your property to seize these improvements without trespassing. Land and improvements are still separate and distinctly assessed from the taxes. That's why banks primarily finance improvements rather than financing land, because they cannot attach liens or foreclose upon land even if it has ever been declared allodial. So are land patents valid? Regarding the validity of allodial titles and land patents, it depends on who you ask. If you ask an attorney, they'll snort and say it has no validity in the courts. If you ask a title insurance company, they'll hiss and snort and turn red in the face from embarrassment. If you ask a clerk at the Bureau of Land Management, simply roll their eyes and say that the land patents are worthless. If you ask a fellow sovereign state citizen who has successfully kept the state or the banks from foreclosing on their property due to a land patent clouding the equitable title, well, then you would say it has validity. I assert there are hundreds of people who have successfully staved off government intervention through the use of land patents. How long this will last depends upon the judicial and political activism of the American people. That's you. Still, there's no better way to cloud an equitable title than to update the land patent in your name. So, with that having been said, it's my pleasure to turn the call over to PJ, and let's have his take on it, because I know that we've talked about this before. And the other thing that I want to mention is that next week we will be talking about boundaries of the United States in meets and bounds. So be here next week, because you're going to learn exactly where the United States exists. So without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the call over to PJ.
Thank you. It's quite interesting. A lot of what you're saying, I don't I don't have enough evidence to agree with you, but not a lot of it, but part of it. And there's parts of it that I absolutely agree with, and we can work through that. One, let's just imagine that you're in court, and the state or the county attorney, because the county collects taxes in their own county under state law. So you're in court, and the county attorney's trying to get evidence out of you that, or out of somebody in the witness stand, that there's a tax obligation due, which means a payment. So let's just say you're in the witness stand, and the prosecutor is going to ask you, is the land in the state, in the city, in the county, in the United States, in the municipality? They can name off a whole bunch of things. And our secret that has been the best for 30 years is not to answer those questions. Just simply say, the prosecutor, the county attorney goes, is your, I was in court, and they, is your land in Douglas County? Or San Francisco County? Whatever county. I just simply said, I have no evidence in my possession that particular piece of land is in such and such county. And then the judge would cut in and say, that's a yes or no answer, sir. And then I would tell the judge, I can't say yes or no because I don't know. But that judge wanted me to say yes or no. And it's fatal if you say yes or no. If you say yes, it's in the county, all land in the county, all land in the state of blah, 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 all land in the state of Arizona, whatever, of the 50 states they call, is taxable. Okay, of course, that means government land in a given area. That's what state of means. That is taxable. And so it's a trick question. So the question that they have to, the evidence that they have to produce is if your land is of the same type of land that is taxable as a matter of law constitutionally. And you want to keep the burden of proof on them. Registering your property could be construed as prima facie evidence of a contractual agreement to pay taxes for services rendered. Now, you could take that into a common law setting, and I think you can convince the majority of the jury that, no, that's not true. The reason people pay taxes is because they don't want to lose their house. They don't want to lose their land. So, I guarantee you that the court is going to try to use an act of registration. You went into one of their offices and you registered your land or your property in their system, it's not good to do that. So what we do is, if we're going to file anything in their system, and we have, as a man, the Articles of Confederation says that they must provide you with a means to operate as a man, as a free inhabitant, without you can take advantage of the benefits and services for simply notifying all who the owner of record is of that land. So what we do is we make sure the document is filed for record instead of register. And they don't like that at all, because the gate watcher immediately says, oh, we can't have any common law language on this document. Now think about it. You're bringing in a document that is a deed, which is evidence of an activity that you participated in to purchase something. The document says what you purchased. Sometimes it says what you paid for it. you don't have to put that on there, but like Michael said, that constitutionally you have access to a higher level court if you pay $20 or more, which is gold standard. $20 is an ounce of gold. So if you pay more than an ounce of gold for it, you have a right to trial by jury, or at least common law. Maybe it's called jury trial. But anyway, if you don't have that, then you don't have the power to have an entire jury assembled of 12 people. Possibly you can have a petite jury. But anyway, if you another question they'll ask, they'll try to get you to associate your land in a court proceeding. They'll talk about real estate. Well, think about it. Real estate, estate. Does that really sound like a common law term, or does that sound like a statutory world? I could tell you anything with the word state in it is going to absolutely be used in their favor. So stay away from anything like that. I would virtually say almost every word on that document is a dangerous word to agree to. Any word that they want you to agree to is a dangerous word to agree to. So if I've learned that you do not testify to anything that they ask you, that you simply say, I have no evidence. They ask you, you know, what is your name? I have no evidence of what my name is. All I know is my parents have called me PJ ever since I can remember. I have no evidence of what my name is. I don't even know what you're talking about, my name. So just completely keep the burden of proof on them. Then they have to put somebody in the witness stand to answer those questions, and you can cross-examine that individual, or you can impeach that individual at any time, because if you bring up evidence that completely is contrary to that man's testimony, you can bring it into the court and correct the record. If that guy in the witness chair says 5 times 5 is 24 and you miss it, you can come in 10 years later and correct the record with evidence that 5 times 5 is 25. That's the way it works. You have a right to correct the record to the factual truths of the matter. Another thing they talk about is real property. And, you know, why are they calling it real property? Is some property not real? Is anything that's tangible not real? There's a reason why they put the word real estate and real property together. I would assume that word real is defined in their statute somewhere. It's completely trickery in my experience. Today I sent off a document because they're threatening to tear down one of my houses for lack of municipal code compliance on it. And I challenge them, you know, what are they relying upon that I'm subject to the municipal code at all? What are they relying upon that land is the same land as anything associated with any city, county, or state, or of the United States? So I go through a negative affirmance and affidavit and so forth and put that. And I mail that to the governor, the mayor, the head code enforcement officers and the enforcement officers that go out and inspect the houses that actually write up the citations. And I go after them in their personal capacity, because there's no reason to go after them in their official capacity if they're not acting officially. They cannot be acting officially unless your land is of their jurisdiction. If they come out and write you a citation for having your front door painted the wrong color, and that land is not of their jurisdiction, they have no ability to claim that it is of their official capacity. It's impossible. they might be deceived into thinking it's their official capacity. Just like I can be deceived into thinking a wooden nickel is a real nickel. But that doesn't change the wooden nickel into a real nickel, even in the slightest bit. So always remember that if they are not within the scope of their authority, they are not in their authority at all. And thus you can go after them for damages in their personal capacity. Now, if you go after them for trying to collect taxes in their personal capacity, it changes the perspective of the case because they cannot use statutory defenses until they prove that they were acting within their statutory capacity, which is going to be very hard if the land or the claimed taxable property is without the United States. I'm looking at my notes here. Allodial title which is interesting. Michael said that it's synonymous with absolute title. Now, absolute title is very similar to the word ultimate title. If you go back into the early constitutions, the first constitutions that were written before statehood of the various independent states, they used the term ultimate title. That's about as ultimate as you're going to get. So I stay away from the word allodial or absolute. I just go right with the word ultimate title, and I reference the constitution of that original state. So, and that's pretty good because they can say they can look at it and say, you know, he's referencing a pretty reliable document there. So, Michael, is anybody raising their hand yet? If you're nearby,
let's cover with the people the routine to follow to be addressed. Press star two on your keypad to raise your hand, ladies and gentlemen. For those on Freedoms Radio, look to the center of your monitor. You'll see the silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. It's empty inside. Left click there, type away your comment or your question. On the outside of the rectangle, you'll see a place to put your contact information. Once done, then hit submit, and I'll be glad to give voice to your comment or question. Meanwhile, those of you who have dialed in, press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. Press star 2. Otherwise, we'll end up with an early call tonight, and that's nothing that we ever want to do. So Kent comes in from West Virginia. Go ahead, Kent.
Thank you. PJ, is there ever a time that you would use the term paramount title rather than ultimate title?
Paramount?
Yeah,
there's
paramount.
No reason to use any. There's no reason to use any other term if you can find it in the organic constitutions, because
okay.
That organic constitution is the basis of their constituted authorities. Okay, that's really good evidence of their limitations. Now, I believe that the original constitutions were chains on the government, just the same as Jefferson said, the Constitution of the United States is a chain on the government. Now, of course, any constitution at that time would probably be understood as a chain on the government, and I believe the subsequent constitutions, which are more corporate constitutions, I guess is one way they say it, is it comes from the same source as the earlier constitutions. And if they were chained, it's impossible for these new ones not to be chained. So I would stick with the word ultimate. Ultimate. Now, what I've been learning from various people that have been in this for many, many years and many court cases and billions of pieces of valued property, up to $30 billion of property being removed from the tax rules in a fashion. Now, when I say remove, that doesn't mean they move them over to the non-taxable rules. That means the people are compensated just the same as if it was moved over to the untaxable rolls. So sometimes they can't move them over because the land has been sold and it's been developed, and yeah, they're gonna keep it in the system, but they're still gonna go back and pay you for the damages they caused by taxing you in the past or taking it away from your family 100 years ago, things like that. So the land patent, the land grants are extremely important, I've been told, in making property tax challenges. And also, it's probably true with mortgage challenges. Generally, biblically, you can't take land away from people. Let's say you have a family. They have 1,000 acres. And a man has 10 kids and a wife. Can he go to town and get drunk and lose his farm in a poker game or some bad business deal? In common law, biblically, no. He can lose it for a time, but the year of Jubilee, it goes right back to his family. So those laws have not changed. God wants the protection of the property to remain with the people. Now, if a lot of people have done research and found that a vast number of the wealth of the nation is gobbled up by corporations who use unequal weights and measures, in a sense, fiat dollars, to acquire wealth. So, for example, a bank will pretend to lend you money, subsidy money, but they didn't. All they did is push a button on a computer and printed out a check and handed it to you. That's a felony, but nobody investigates it because banks are criminal organizations, and the federal judges and the county judges know that if they go against the bank, they're possibly going to be killed or voted out of office. Somebody will fund enough money to get any judge out of office. When they have fiat money that they can get with the push of a button, that's a lot of advertising power. And if they can't do it that way easily, they'll just kill you. I know people that personally know judges that have been killed for ruling against the banks, and their wives have been killed, and their bodies were never found. And that message goes all across the nation to every judge, every banker, every lawyer in the nation, and they know the price of that game to play. So the principle, I think, you can convince a jury of 12 in common law that you can't lose your land. And I think the people would agree. The Bible teaches that. So that would certainly be a legal premise I would bring of God's law into a courtroom. And I think the jury would agree with you. Especially if you can prove that the bank never gave any subsidy money and they're taking your house because of it. It's insane. When things are done right, people don't lose their land. They have tough years. They go for years without making a crop or stuff like that, but they don't lose their land. It isn't taken. In Nebraska, there's land. When I was in the Depression, land was lost over $7.50 tax owed. They didn't have any money. They had 1,000 acres. They couldn't come up with $7,500. $7,500 was a lot of money back in the Depression times. $750 was a lot of money to come up with. And they lost their 1,000 acres of land. And that land is worth $10,000 an acre nowadays, if not $15,000. So, and if it's close to a city, it's $1 million an acre. But anyway, the family lost it over $7.50 of taxes. That wasn't even due as a matter of law. The legal system took it from them, the corrupt lawyers. And I blame it on the churches because the churches are not standing up to protect the people's rights. So you have another question? Yeah, that was a good question you had there, though.
Yeah, thank you. I do want to ask another question. On Saturday night when Bernie was on, there was a comment made about this being a multi-step process. And I think that while you're on the phone tonight, it's appropriate to ask this question. And then when GW was on, this was spoken of again, but in a little different way. And that was that, first of all, you're correcting your status. Second of all, you're getting a passport. But thirdly, if you wanted to be finished with the system entirely, and that is to say be removed from Social Security, et cetera, you would then do revocations, rescissions, et cetera. And that was discussed in a little more detail on Saturday night. Now, while one is going through this process, you're talking, for example, about problems that you're having with a property that they want to tear down that you own. I don't know that you own that in your own name or some other type of name or some corporate entity or association.
It'd be my name.
Okay. So do you feel comfortable assuming your status is not corrected, or even if it is corrected and they're dealing with you in this tax system that they have, this basically fictitious or de facto system, do you feel comfortable going into their courts without them having come back and claim that you're really a federal citizen? Because there seems to be a fine line here in how you get this all accomplished when you have a lot of ancillary issues that are still pending. And the older you are, the more issues you have, as I've mentioned in the past. So could you comment a little bit on that if you follow what I'm asking?
Yeah, I'm good enough in court where I know how to pay attention to every question and make sure that I don't make any statements and keep the burden of proof on them. So no matter what they ask, I mean, if they ask me what name do I respond to, I'll give them that information. What day I was born, I'll give them that information. I'll only give them that information based on what somebody told me. And my mailing location, I'll give them that. But as far as anything else, I'm not going to give them any information. I might give them information of the day I purchased some land and the property on that land, because that's part of my claim. But I keep the burden of proof on them. They are coming in trying to take the land for municipal codes or property taxes. Where in the Constitution are you allowed to take my land for taxes? Your Honor, where in the Constitution are you allowed to take my land for the taxes? And the judge will turn to the county attorney and says, county attorney, do you have a response to that? And then I'll say, Your Honor, he doesn't have to give me a response orally. I don't want a response orally. I want a response in written format so that I can take it to counsel and have it examined for truthfulness and accuracy. So I don't want oral evidence from him. And attorneys cannot testify, Your Honor. So if he's going to bring evidence, he needs to have somebody in the witness chair that's sworn in and that is on the record. So I don't want him pretending to put evidence before the court. So I shut him down that way. And so they go get somebody to put in the witness chair, and they'll bring up something like the land is situated in the county. And then I'll cross-examine, what evidence you have that the land is in the county? Well, everybody knows that. The plat map shows that it's in the county. What's the definition of county in this court, in the United States system? Well, I don't know. Then I give them a document that shows them the definition of county in the statutes of large, which the Supremacy Clause requires all state U.S. courts to go by. The same definition, it means it's government owned. so the county assessor is sitting in that chair like, I didn't know that. So do you have any evidence that land there is that exhibit A that's highlighted in red, that land is owned by the United States as a possession or territory? I don't know. And then, Your Honor, I'll give this guy 30 days to find that evidence, because this entire case hinges on that. If he could find evidence that this land is a possession or territory of the United States, which is evidence that it's in the county, I'll write a check that day, Your Honor, for property taxes rightfully due. And that really puts that judge in a tremendous bind, because that's a pretty darn good deal for everybody. But what we've been discovering is the judges are ignoring it, and they just summarily ruling against you and say, if you don't like my ruling, take it on appeal. See, the judge can't make a ruling to violate your rights. If you have property rights, guess what? A judge does not have authority to take your property rights away from you or your land rights away from you. You can have him arrested for doing that. I have a friend that brings in a U.S. Marshal, and he has the judge arrested for violating such rights. And he explains to the judge that, judge, if you rule that way without evidence, you're violating my rights without evidence to do so. And the U.S. Marshal here has, he quotes the statute, he's got authority to arrest you right now. He has authority to arrest a standing judge. And the judge will say, I'm going to take this under advisement. I see this where this is going. So it's a battleground. You don't want to do the battleground in court oral arguments. And besides, the attorney doesn't have any authority to put evidence before the court. He's got to have a witness. That's your most important thing you need to understand. Make sure that the evidence comes through a witness sworn in on the witness stand and no other way. Don't let any documents come into that evidence box without having foundation of a sworn in witness. They'll tear you apart.
Share with us real quickly the different types of filings that you can do at a recorder's office. Some filings are private, some are public. Some you actually, you know, transfer the property to the state recorder. So can you expound on that for a minute?
Their system there is it's arranged predominantly for their system. Remember that. Their system is there predominantly for their system. Now, the Articles of Confederation says that all of their system has to be copacetic and compliant with the rights of man. So all of their system has to be, cannot violate your rights. And they cannot deprive you of of their services. So if they have a service that gives the world public notice of owner of a automobile or a piece of land, by law, by constitution, they have to allow you to use that. And they can't use that to deprive you of your rights. So you don't have to. If you buy a car from me, you don't have to register it. But it's to your advantage to take it to their system and get it in their system so that if it's ever stolen, it's retrievable. There's reasons for that. There's a lot of good reasons for it. It's a good thing. I had an automobile stolen here in Texas. Just bought it. Had it less than 2 weeks. It was stolen. I went to report it as stolen. They said you can't report it as stolen unless it's been registered. I said I'm not going to register it. You can't report it stolen. Well, the owner put in a document that says he sold it to me with the state record. We don't care. You have to register it before we can report it stolen. So I'm going to take them into federal court, sue them, because they can't force you to register your automobile as a commercial a device used for commercial transportation. They can't do it. The same way with land. They cannot make you record or register or file for record your land purchase. They have no authority to make you do that. It's to your advantage to do that because you want your neighbors to know that you own it. And if your neighbor sees somebody out there dumping nuclear waste on your land, you want your neighbors to be able to contact the owner immediately so that you can get out there and put a stop to it. There's lots of reasons why you want somebody to know who owns land. Now, there's lots of reasons you don't want nobody to know who owns the land also in some situations. So that both ways can play. I can have a watch on my wrist, and you might own it. I don't have to tell the world that you own it. I don't have to tell the world that I own it. There's no law that requires that. And nobody can take it away from you unless they got proof that they own it or they got evidence that the owner is giving them permission to take it away from me. So does that help answer your question a little bit?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Now, I'm sorry, I don't, Michael, I don't really know of all the other options as far as registering and all. Only two I've ever been associated with is the difference between file for record and register. Now, an individual that I talked to used some of my documents and went in, and the person said that, you know, these aren't quite right. You know, we don't do these. And it was one of their documents. We just filled it out differently. And we put private dwelling in one of their lines because they had a box to check for real estate or agriculture, or like three or four different things to check. Then they had a blank of others, other, and we just wrote in private dwelling. And that clerk came back and leaned over the counter and says, if you put private dwelling there, we can't charge you property taxes. I don't think she was supposed to tell her that. But and she goes, yeah, that's exactly why we're doing it that way. And that person never did get back to me. It's been a few months. I was quite interested what became of that. And she didn't get back to me. But anyway, go ahead. Somebody,
the thing that I wanted to point out was that the recording was one thing, and your public notice was another, and that there was a major difference. For those of you on the call that are old enough to remember Bullwinkle and Moose, there was Polly Pureheart, and there was Snidely Whiplash. Snidely Whiplash was always after Polly Pureheart's deed to the ranch that she owned. And, he would look all over her place for the deed. The deed was not kept at the county recorder's office. The government was never mentioned because there was a time before the government got involved with all of this instrumentation that people actually held their deeds. When if they had a mortgage, when they had the mortgage, the bank held the deed. And when the mortgage was paid off, the original note and the deed that the bank held was then returned back to the homeowner. And they would have a mortgage, a note burning party, because the note was satisfied, they'd light a match to it, torch it. And the deed was returned again to a safe place. Whoever held the deed, it was kind of like a bond. What are those bonds? There's a type of a bond that is open. They don't even allow you to use them anymore, but you could have unnamed bonds, and whoever was the possessor of those bonds was the owner of the bond. It's the same thing.
It's like a deed is very much like a bill of sale. Go ahead.
Yeah, you're exactly right. So when you're, say that you're going to buy a car, I would be having the contract between myself and the car dealer, you know, for 21 silver dollars plus other valuable consideration. Well, that other valuable consideration can be cash or what. It doesn't matter, check. But 21 silver dollars seals it in American common law. But that's only available to people who have corrected their status. Now, where PJ comes in, and it's always been there, and before PJ, there was Tony Davis. Now we have the team. I refer to the team because there are other people now associated with PJ. They come into this to show you how to regain your status under the original de jure republic. that you've been hijacked out of. So, you know, there's always going to be fights, and you're always going to need people like PJ and the team that can help you navigate through those fights and avoid the traps and the pitfalls that are purposely placed there by attorneys, by members of the bar, to pervert and corrupt your attempts. So with that having been said, anybody else? Oh, Michael, you raised your hand from Las Vegas. Go ahead, guy.
It's Bearer Bonds.
Bearer Bonds, that's correct. Bearer Bonds. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, I missed last night, so I just thought I'd listen in tonight. Thank you.
Well, for everyone that's on the call that wants to know where the archives can be found, Bernie has been very gracious to allow me to list all the archives from all the calls, live calls, on his website at Telegram, his page at Telegram, so you can find it there. All right, thank you, Michael. Next is Nancy. Go ahead, Nancy.
Well, I have a question that's not on topic that you've been discussing tonight, but I received a letter from the State Correction Department in order to receive some restitution from a burglary that was a couple years ago. They sent me a W-9 form to fill out, and it says where you sign it, it says U.S. person. And I didn't know really how to respond to that, but that's what they want me to do in order to get the restitution.
Yeah, there's a,
so I
you can
my
use
question
a W.
Is how would I sign that?
You can use a W-8 form instead. A W-9 form is for a U.S. citizen. A W-8 form is for a non-U.S. citizen.
Well, they're assuming that I am, so that's why they sent me a W-9. And
but you can you just send the W-9 back to them, not just completely blank, and add the W-8 to it with an affidavit. That's how we do it.
Okay. Right, and then they wanted to make a direct deposit of that, but I don't have a bank account in my name. So
but anyway, you can ask them if they'll deposit into another bank account for you. They
right.
want a record
or
of transfer, so go ahead and work
what?
With that. They want a record of transfer, so go ahead and work with them.
But I'll ask them if I can put it in another account or get a check and then sign the check into one of my trust accounts or other account that I have a relation
with.
That's
hard to do, so be careful. Make sure you check it out before you do that.
What? You mean you can't deposit a check into another account that you're the signatory on?
I don't know. It's got to be made out to that account.
Oh.
On the back of the check. On the back of the check, you can sign the check and then write pay to the order of whatever the trust is, et cetera. The other thing that
they don't
I will
like
be doing
to,
the moment.
They don't like to do that anymore. I've tried it, but that might just be my bank. But go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, one of the things that I want to do the moment that I have my State Department acknowledgement of correcting my status is to take that paperwork into a bank that does not know me, and I'll walk in with cash and simply say I want to open up a checking account. Here's my identification, and here is the cash to deposit. Here's $5,000 to open the account with, something like that. See what happens.
Okay, what if I sign on that W-9 sign by semicolon and then my name?
We'll have to go through the whole W-9 with you, so W-8 with you. So you don't want to put a W-9 in there. That's a US citizen document. Don't do it.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Google W-8. I think it's called W-8 Ben, I think it's called. Okay, next.
Yeah, and last is Miss Jennifer. Go right ahead.
Oh,
yeah,
hi,
you.
I'm here.
wake up, wherever you are.
I have a question about beds. Hang on, now you've taken that out of my brain. Oh, well. Oh, first of all, I don't know. I've tried to find Bernie on Telegram, and I can't find him anywhere. So could you send me a link to his Telegram, please? And
I have.
Oh, that's right. So I have my trusts and everything and a bank, and I had to fill out a W-9 when I opened the accounts. Can I, after I change my status, after I correct my status, can I go back in and say I want to switch out the W-9 for the W-8? Would that be...
Yes.
Yes,
they can do that all the time. And then you put an affidavit with it that supports the purpose of your activity. So,
okay. I'm not sure. I just didn't know if the W-9 was for me or for the trust. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But anyway, well, that's good to know.
Well, I don't know. I just don't know. So.
Right.
But anyway,
well, I guess
you as a you as a man, you're a female, but as a man, you have right to put in a correct record, and that correct record is that you've never elected to become a United States citizen. That's one of the lines in the affidavit that you put with it.
Right. Okay. Good to know.
Okay. Okay, let's close her up, Michael. I got some business to do here.
I want to thank everyone for joining us tonight. And, again, remind you that if you go to Telegram and you just type in Bernie Bashir, you'll find his room, and all of the archives are held there. Michael in California, or rather it's Las Vegas, I meant to say, check your inbox. I just sent you last night's recording. Good night, everybody. Until next week, be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.